Welcome back to Good Dirt, conversations with leaders in real estate and beyond. Today's guest, a familiar name to many, Frank McCourt Jr., will be a bit of a throwback for a lot of our Boston area listeners and will be a fun listen for sure for all who enjoy a good real estate story. Frank's central role in what has become Boston's Seaport District is the stuff of real estate legend. And we dive into not only that project, but what became before it for Frank and maybe more interestingly, what came after it or because of it, including the acquisition and the landmark sale of the Los Angeles Dodgers, his ownership of the French football club Olympique de Marseille, and a long list of interesting private investments in real estate, private equity, sports and entertainment, and perhaps most importantly, what we would call philanthropy of epic proportions.
A little bit of background on Frank McCourt. Frank is a civic entrepreneur and the executive chairman and former CEO of McCourt Global, a private family company committed to building a better future through its work across the real estate, sports, technology, media, and capital investment industries, as well as its significant philanthropic activities. As he shares in our conversation, Frank is proud to extend his family's 130-year legacy of merging community and social impact with financial results, an approach that started when the original McCourt Company was launched in Boston in 1893. He is a passionate supporter of multiple academic, civic, and cultural institutions and initiatives, most notably perhaps his $100 million gift to Georgetown University to create the McCourt School of Public Policy in 2013, and is doubling down with an additional $100 million investment in 2021 to catalyze an inclusive pipeline of public policy leaders and put the school on a path to becoming tuition-free.
It's pretty amazing. This conversation was a ton of fun for us. With family roots in the construction business, many in the Boston area know that dates back to the late 19th century. Frank has certainly built upon the history with the development of the Seaport to large mixed-use projects in Dallas, London, Miami, New York City, and elsewhere across the world. But today, as a proud father of seven, Frank is focusing his time, capital, and energy on repairing what he believes is the greatest threat to our society and coming generations. Through his role as founder and executive chairman of Project Liberty, a far-reaching $500 million initiative to transform the internet through a new, equitable technology infrastructure and to rebuild social media in a way that enables users to own and control their personal data. The project includes the development of a groundbreaking open-source internet protocol called the Decentralized Social Networking Protocol, or DSNP, which will be owned by the public to serve as a new web infrastructure. It's a lot to digest, and I think that if you listen to Frank and hear his perspective on this major issue, like us, your eyes will be opened and you'll take this very seriously.
We talk a lot in the podcast about his book, Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, which was published by Crown on March 12, 2024. And we urge you all to get your hands on a copy.
I recently read the book, and I have to say it was, like I said, eye-opening for me and has sort of spurred my own reckoning with the role of technology in my life and going forward has definitely called into question the role that I want technology to play in the lives of my children. And this has become a hot topic recently. There's an article in The Atlantic last week called End the Phone-Based Childhood Now. I think a lot of folks that listen to this interview and that have children or grandchildren who are approaching the age where they're going to get a smartphone in their hands are going to think twice about that and start to have some serious conversations about what we should be doing as a society to protect our kids.
Yeah, this was a great conversation, and Frank's roots in the Seaport and that transaction is really Boston real estate legend. But we really go to the beyond, right? This is conversations with leaders in real estate and beyond, and Frank has transcended real estate and is now beyond and solving some pretty big problems or trying to, and we're all in. So we hope you enjoy the conversation. Please download, share, and enjoy it.
And we have links in the bio, as always, to get your hands on a copy of the book. And we look forward to continuing the discussion with Frank and with anyone who this resonates with. Thank you very much.
Hello, and welcome back to Good Dirt, conversations with leaders in real estate and beyond. Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Frank McCourt, the executive chairman of McCourt Global and the founder of Project Liberty. Frank, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's good to see you guys again. How are you doing today?
All good. We've been excited for this conversation for a while now, and I think it's timed very nicely with what you've been up to, and I think a message that we'd like to get out to our world. Frank, you have a very deep history in the city of Boston from a real estate and development standpoint. We want to talk about that, but I think your family's legacy goes back over a century. Your story is fascinating to many, from the Boston Seaport to the Dodgers to Project Liberty today and what you're up to. So we'd love it if you could give us a quick overview of McCourt Global And then maybe if we could take a step back and go back as far as you're comfortable going and telling the Frank McCourt story.
Well, yeah, we'll start with the company as it exists today. We have a great firm that now spans the globe, involved in, of course, our core businesses of construction and real estate and infrastructure. But also now we have the privilege of being deeply involved in the sports and media worlds, technology world, the finance business and capital allocation and so forth. And yeah, we operate in coast to coast and in other cities around the world. So it's been a great journey. I feel I've lived a privileged life and very proud of what I've accomplished, but I'm very mindful that I've done it on the shoulders of a lot of people and generations before me. And I now have, as of about a year ago, stepped out of the CEO role into the executive chairman role as so that I could allocate more time to Project Liberty, which I'm sure we'll be talking about in a few moments.
Absolutely. And we want to go back to kind of your college days and all that great stuff. But we're talking about McCourt Global, and you mentioned some of your enterprises, sports being one of them. That's something we're particularly excited to hear about. American baseball is a topic we know fairly well, but European football is not. You were the owner of Los Angeles Dodgers. I believe you're still the chairman of the Los Angeles Marathon and Marseille, the football club in France. How did you get into that business? When did that start? And how exciting is that as a sports person to be affiliated with that program?
Yeah, after selling the Dodgers, which was a great privilege to be a steward of that amazing franchise, I was approached about buying a European football club. And the one that caught my eye was Marseille because it's the largest in France. And you know how European football works, or maybe I shouldn't assume that. You know, it's really about getting in the Champions League in right. European football every year. So Marseille is a club that should be in the Champions League every year. It had kind of fallen on hard times. Very similar, by the way, to the Dodgers when I had purchased it. Both great franchises or clubs, let's call them teams. Tremendous history, incredible fan bases, great venues. They'd won the big prizes in the past, but they just lost a little bit of their luster and kind of gotten off the track a bit. And in the Dodgers case, believe it or not, they hadn't won a postseason game in 16 years when I purchased them.
But you recognize the brand. I mean, it's the Dodgers. So yeah. They have this great brand. It's fascinating to hear that they hadn't won a playoff game in so long.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great brands, not only in baseball, but what they've done, what they've meant to America and Jackie Robinson and so on and so forth. So Marseille, very similar. Only French club to ever win the Champions League. So we grew up in a sports town. I'm a Bostonian. So everybody's kind of dream is to own a professional club, a professional team. And my dream was fulfilled with the Dodgers. And I kind of checked that box, honestly. And I wasn't intent on owning another sports team. But I said to myself, if it was going to be another team, it was going to be a European football club because that is the world's sport.
Right.
And there's another aspect of owning an internationally recognized sports team. And that is, it really helps open doors everywhere in the world. The team itself is not about business. It has to be about sport, but it does help you create connections, network, open doors. And I can go anywhere in the world and people know about Marseille and want to talk about the club and what I screwed up or when the team is playing well, how great it is. So it's a common language. We know it's growing up in Boston, right? You can get into a cab in the old days or an Uber today and first thing you can do is talk about sports.
Yeah.
That's a safe conversation. That's a fun one. Just like we're backseat drivers, we're armchair general managers, right? And so to be able to actually own a club and call the shots, it's an incredible privilege. And I say own very, very loosely because we don't own these things. These are owned by the community. And really, you get to be a steward for a period of time or your family does and so forth. So that brought me to Marseille. You mentioned the marathon. Growing up in Boston here, I saw the power of the Boston Marathon. And it's a civic asset in the truest sense of the words. And people run the marathon for a cause usually, right? Maybe they run it to challenge themselves. But most of us run a marathon. We say we're going to raise money for X, Y, or Z. So I really felt the LA Marathon shouldn't be a private asset. So when I purchased it years ago, changed the course so that it started at Dodger Stadium, finished up in Santa Monica, the ocean, the so-called Stadium to the Sea course, fixed it so that it actually was a moneymaker, not a money loser. And then I contributed it to our foundation, the McCourt Foundation, which started here in Boston 35 plus years ago and started by my cousins, which has done great work here and elsewhere over the years. And I felt the marathon should be owned by a not-for-profit. And now it's a massive fundraising machine and there's a number of other road races involved and it's in great hands. And I feel good about it because it was my grandfather that owned a piece of the Boston Braves years ago. And I'm not sure people realize it, but it was he and a bunch of contractors that when they owned the Braves, they started the Jimmy Fund. And we all know what the Jimmy Fund means to this community.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's incredible. And we're going to come back to sports throughout the conversation. Tommy couldn't resist going right to it. But the vehicle that a marathon can serve in a community in around the world to help raise money for various causes, we see it firsthand through our involvement in a number of charities, but namely the Corey Griffin Foundation. It's probably our most efficient fundraiser, but it's so powerful for all the people involved. So it's an incredible gesture what you did there and sort of fixed that event. And then now it's in good hands for the long term. If we can go back and start off with your family's origins, really in Ireland, but then in Boston, I would like to talk about the path that sort of led to you're getting into the development and construction business and the real estate business, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, so great-great-grandfather came here from Ireland with a 13-year-old son named John. And he grew up here, worked for the Boston Gas Company, started as a laborer, became a foreman, and had a good union job, safe, secure, made a good living, and had become an American and Bostonian, and was able then to start his own family and so forth. And when he was 50 years old, he took a leap to start a company. And it was called the John McCourt Company. And that was founded in 1893 as a road building firm. So that was at the moment in time where the automobile was invented. And then shortly thereafter, Henry Ford started building automobiles at scale. And I guess my great-grandfather saw what was coming when it came to infrastructure generally. I mean, started as a road builder and then, you know, major utilities, infrastructure of all kinds that was horizontal in nature. It was a civil construction, kind of what's called heavy and highway construction. You know, we built airports and tunnels and bridges and things like that as the company grew. During the war years, built all the airports around New England, including an airfield here in Boston. It's now called Logan. I think my family's been building Logan Airport continuously since World War II, and we're proud of it. My grandfather was involved in building the Central Artery, my brother Richie, in terms of taking it down and doing the big dig. And now his three boys, Ryan and Matt and Trevor, are running the construction company. They're still located here in Boston, still going strong. You can see the trucks and the backhoes and the loaders. And
I think I saw 10 of them on my way in this morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're everywhere, and it's a good thing. It means the company's vibrant. It employs a lot of people and gets to do its work not only here but elsewhere. And yeah, I had the privilege in 1977, I think it was, to step out and start our real estate group. I was really interested in vertical construction. And as I said, the company really has a great deal of expertise in horizontal construction and a lot of the stuff that you don't see, but we rely on for our lives to work, including the internet, which we'll get to, I'm sure, soon. But I was interested in expanding into the vertical end of the business, started winning some contracts and actually getting some traction. And then we decided to separate that company from the family jewel. And big public works projects, you require whoever you're doing it for, the federal government, the state, the city, or whatever, they require to be fully bonded and so on and so forth. So the bonding companies and the banks don't like to see the real estate
development
activity
risk and all that.
Yeah, they had the balance sheet confused or mixed together. So they want to see a nice, clean, crisp balance sheet on the construction side, because they're saying, like, we are guaranteeing that this work will be completed. And when you get into tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, that surety is really important. So we decided to split it off, and I started the real estate group, as I said, in 77 or so. And I remember my dad saying to me and my first employee, Austin Regalino, who still sits ex officio with the company, we said, good luck to you guys. And remember, there's always a desk here for you. So to be able to start knowing that I had to do it on my own, but my safety net was knowing I had a family that had my back. And I was way bigger than handing me a check. And so off I went. And as I said, I had already landed a few jobs that we were doing of a building nature. And then the Union Wharf here on the waterfront, that was the first big step forward. I'd done a lot of smaller projects. I got involved in Union Wharf, which I think at the time, these were the first new residences built in Boston in many years, you know, single family, because we had those townhouses along
the
edge.
So this is early 80s at this point? Or
still in the 70s.
Still in the 70s. Yeah,
and late 70s. And we converted the wharf itself, an old warehouse that was converted into office condominiums, office and retail on the grade floor, and then on the ground floor, and then residences above. Built, I believe it was 23 new townhouses right on the water's edge, a marina, and a small office building, which became my HQ. For years here in Boston, I was in that building right on Commercial Street there and, yeah, at the foot of Union Wharf. And those were great times. And then we kind of priced ourselves right out of the market because the waterfront took on a whole different vibe.
Yeah. You were the catalyst behind making it more expensive to get control of a project there.
Yeah.
Probably.
We kept on looking at other projects and put a price tag on it. And then someone would come in. And so I decided to look around and say, okay, where's the next big thing?
And the central artery is still up in the middle of town now.
The right? Central artery is still.
People can envision it.
Pretty big dig.
Yeah. And yeah, we looked around and saw this massive undeveloped property over in what's now the Seaport. It was pretty much abandoned railroad yards at the time. And the highways had made it more and more difficult for rail to exist in this country because rail was great at moving things, but you had to get the things to the train and then get the things off the train to the destination. And so with trucking, you could just pick the things up wherever they were located and drive to where you wanted to drop them off. So you eliminated a lot of handling. And so the highway system had a big impact on the railroad system in this country. And you guys are too young, but there was a time when Penn Central was the big railroad company and it went bankrupt. And our government kind of stepped in and the passenger pieces of that rail became what is now called Amtrak. And the non-passenger pieces, the stuff that individual citizens didn't depend on every day to move around, went bankrupt and the assets were sold off. And they had great real estate assets, both here and in New York and elsewhere.
The Seaport land, is that what that was at that point? People look back at the aerials and say, remember when? What was it?
We're young, but we remember when, because we were talking earlier before we started here. Our father, who worked downtown, used to drive in from the South Shore and park on those lots, on those dirt lots back in the day. So it's not that long ago. We remember when it was in that condition as well.
Yeah, these were essentially abandoned railroad yards. And there were a couple of restaurants in that area, Anthony's Pier 4 and Jimmy's Harborside. And so people were familiar with it because of those restaurants, a little bit familiar. But it was industrial property that had been rail yards. It had been kind of the back of the house for Boston. This is how Boston was supplied, so to speak, with provisions and so on and so forth. And it had just slowly deteriorated as the need for rail disappeared, rail to deliver goods. And the warehouses were abandoned. And it started to just attract just a vagrant population. And the warehouses were getting, people were dumping their trash in it. And so literally, I mean, it was an eyesore and so on and so forth. And it was a very clear at the time, and this goes back to my infrastructure and building background, that if any of the projects that were on the drawing board at the time, because depressing the central artery and or a third harbor tunnel were debated in this town for a long time before they were actually done. And there was a Democratic administration, the Dukakis administration, that wanted to take down the artery, depress it, and reconnect the city to the water. And there was a Republican administration with Governor King, he had been the former head of the Mass Port Authority, who wanted to extend the turnpike and build the Third Harbor Tunnel to the airport. And neither got enough votes from the other side, so there were two different ideas. And then Governor Dukakis came back into power as governor, and Fred Savucci was his Secretary of Transportation. And I think Fred figured out that, okay, this time around, why don't we do both? And that way, I've got the people that want the Third Harbor Tunnel with me on what I want, which is the depression of the artery. And it became the Central Artery Third Harbor Tunnel project. And so two individual big projects became one big, massive project. So that was being discussed for years. And if either, never mind both of those projects happened, this vacant eyesore land out of sight, out of mind was going to become very valuable. And then there was discussion about a new silver line for the T, which if that happened, then that was going to be a big shot in the arm for the area. And then there was discussion about a new courthouse. And then there was discussion about a new convention center. And then there was and so on and so forth. And if any of this stuff happened, it would change the area, especially the infrastructure enabling access to the area, because it was limited access because it was on the other side of the channel. So just you relied on the three bridges. But what happened, and it was just providential, was that all of these projects happened. And so something that was out of sight, out of mind, became good dirt.
Yeah, right? there you go. The best dirt. We'd call that great dirt, actually.
Yeah, it was really awesome. And I'll tell you a couple interesting stories about the evolution of the property. It mentioned that it was really messed up in terms of people abusing the property. So I wanted to get in there and clean it up. Just clean it up, take down the buildings that were falling apart, pull up the track that was no longer being used, grade the property, secure it, and so forth. And I had a great, great friend, no longer with us, name was Billy Consalvo, who was, you know, my dad had helped really put in business because he was a very, very smart guy who had a trucking business that he had expanded. There was a day, actually, you would pay someone to deliver material and you would pay someone to remove it. I'm talking about gravel and excavation and so forth. So Billy would get paid for delivering material to one place while he was getting paid to take it from some other place. And he was just connecting dots, right? Which is what entrepreneurs do. And so he came to me and he said, Frank, you get this property and Massport wants to fill in, create another pier. Right. I think it was called like the Subaru Pier for a while or something here because it was to bring in automobiles and store them at scale. So they're going to have a project and they're going to need all this fill in order to fill it in. But it's not going to happen for about a year. And there's another project right now, big excavation project, which is to create the Orange Line. And I want to get the project to do the excavation, but I need a place to put the fill until Massport needs it to fill in the pier. So can I put it on your land? I said, yeah, here's the deal. If you tear down all the buildings and remove all of that, remove the track, grade the property, fence it, I want a pool table here, something that's clean and secure, then you can put your material on the site. And you don't have to pay me anything, but you have to do all that work. And he said, okay, that's a deal. So he did all the work. He did the excavation for the Orange Line, brought about almost 500,000 cubic yards of material over to our property, put it on the property. And so people old enough that might have driven by there or looked at would have seen there was like a mountain of excavation on that property for about a year. And then who is best situated to get the contract to fill in the pier and just bring the material down the street, down Northern Avenue, but Billy. And so he removed that material. And so the site was pristine.
Yeah.
And then I got a call from Mayor White. Kevin White was the mayor. And the tall ships were coming to Boston. And he wanted to know, could he use the property to park cars? Because there was going to be a lot of people coming into the city to look at the tall ships. And this was really the resurgence of the waterfront, you know, when hundreds of thousands of people came into downtown Boston to witness this parade of tall ships and parked now in this part of the city and understood that all this real estate existed. The city had turned and built itself in a westerly direction, right, towards the Back Bay and all in that direction. And the waterfront, which was the barrier of the central artery, plus the fact that the old rail yards were kind of a no man's land, we had turned our back on our harbor. And there was a time when it was actually quite polluted. And the other thing that was happening is that there was a federal judge said you have to clean up the water. And that was happening at the same time. So there was just this environmental awareness that we had this, and just this general awareness. We have this awesome harbor.
Right.
This is how the city started. This is where it started. This could be a huge, huge public resource again. And let's clean it up and let's embrace the harbor.
Yeah.
In our heritage.
Activate the waterfront, which it's amazing to look back and think it hadn't been the case before.
Other than going to Anthony's or Jimmy's.
You aren't down there.
Before, when it was vibrant rail, it's a different story. It was an industrial area. You know about all the wharf buildings Boston Wharf had there and that are all now converted into great uses. And of course, the seaport's entirely different now. But it was really interesting. And it really all went back. And this has been a big part of, I think, how I think about projects is connecting infrastructure to what's going to happen in the future. And when I worked for my dad, as I grew up in the business, and I think I had every job imaginable from the most menial to a point where I was actually running projects and so forth, I saw wherever we went, built a subway stop or built a highway interchange or even just redid streets and sidewalks and put in new lighting and trees, wherever we went, I saw the activity follow. People would build office parks at a highway interchange, right? They'd build apartment buildings or office buildings around a subway stop. We saw how in this town, the resurgence of the South End, right? Just by fixing the streets.
So you saw the power of investing and fixing infrastructure firsthand. What an interesting perspective.
It was a great lesson for me. And it was also what is fundamentally an engine for this country and our economy, because we as citizens pay taxes. Those dollars go to the government. The government redeploys those dollars. And if they do that in a meaningful, non-wasteful way at building meaningful infrastructure that helps all of us, then the private sector comes in and invests on top of that. And you have a great virtuous circle. I fly all over this country and I look down and it's amazing what we've built in a couple hundred years in this country. You think about a couple hundred years, not a long time. And even in this city here, we read about the very birth of this country happening here in this city. And this was just a teeny place. And look what it is now. And it just shows you the power we as people have and the power we've been given by this great country and this idea of entrepreneurship and innovation and the spirit, right? The individual spirit to see the future and create it and be allowed to do that. What a privilege that is. And so, yeah, the connection between the so-called horizontal construction and the vertical construction was something that I learned when I was quite young. And it's a profound thing. And when you kind of really fully appreciate it, and I can't even tell you how great it was from my perspective to be able to hang out with my dad when I was a little kid and see how it all works. And then I'd look forward to getting out on summers so I could go to work and build things and so forth, and to actually kind of get your hands dirty and build it and see how it works and know how it works and appreciate the effort that people have to put all the pieces together. So it just gave me a great love of people in the industry that actually build this stuff and can look back at the end of a day or a week or a year, or sometimes these projects take 5 or 10 years to build, and look back and say, hey, we did that.
Yeah. Well, there's absolutely a theme here, and it's making more sense as we continue the discussion, but this desire to create and build infrastructure that allows for prosperity in the community and safety and wellness in the community. We're going to come back to that when we get to Project Liberty. But it's funny, you talk about the tall ships, and that kicked off the parking in the seaport. I remember, because that was the early 90s, I remember the Boston Harbor Hotel must have been built in the previous decade. I don't know. But we went there with our parents and we parked. I remember this. We parked over in the seaport and we walked. Remember?
I think Rick Kelleher snuck
us
in.
Rick Kelleher had us at the Boston Harbor Hotel.
We still have the plastic cups.
Knowing you guys, you figured out a way to park for free, right?
Yeah, I think we probably did. We knew our way around those lots.
But, oh, yeah.
And we walked over there and saw the tall ships. I remember I was 7, 8, 9 years old. And that was a big moment in Boston when the tall ships came. But I didn't put it in context of how Boston's waterfront was changing. So this is informative for me.
You might even be talking about the second time they came, and I might be talking about the first time they
came.
Yeah,
it could be.
I was a kid.
It was a big, big, big moment for the town, and us appreciating what we had that we weren't using correctly, and we had kind of actually abused it a little bit, right? Because it was a dumping ground in a way, and the harbor and the water had become the same. And so that was kind of the beginning of, I think, the renaissance of Boston, you know, which we're now benefiting happily today. I'm a student of history, right? So I love history and I'm kind of amazed at how much we can learn by studying it and so forth. And Boston went through a period where they were the financial capital of the world, and then we lost that to New York, and then we were the mini computer, the computing capital of the world, and we had those big companies out of 128 in the city, and then we kind of lost that to Silicon Valley. And the resurgence I'm talking about of really appreciating what we had and its physical beauty and the history and what kind of made us tick, and reconnecting to that gave us the dirt we needed and the infrastructure we needed for the biotech boom that Boston is now just massively benefited from. And you look at Kendall Square is adjacent to MIT and near to Harvard, and those incredibly precious institutions that is now completely full. And the Seaport, obviously, is a huge beneficiary of this real resurgence of the city and its unique place to fuse universities and the hospitals and the entrepreneurship and the creativity. But you need a place to put this stuff. And yeah, tech is great and we could do things virtually, but there is no replacement for the ability to actually bring people together and build things. And a lot of ideas emerge out of spontaneous conversations and just crossing paths with someone and being able to share something and a light bulb goes off. It's just, the tech is great. We all use it and we benefit from being able to stay connected somewhat, particularly through something like COVID. But we can't lose sight of how creativity really works and what the tech is supposed to enable. It's a tool to make us better at things. It's not the end, the end all, be all. Well,
Griff might jump in here and make you repeat this for everyone that's downtown right now, because you're speaking our language. And we do believe that being in the built environment together is what creates everything that comes after it. The parking lots were kicked off. You were involved in the master planning of the Seaport, which was a huge endeavor. What should go there? You would talk about the Silver Line, the courthouse. Of course, now we look over the Seaport. We can walk across the hall here and look out the windows. Billions and billions and billions of dollars investment. Jobs, housing, phenomenal retail, a lot of life sciences going on there. Just an incredible real estate case study. You went through that process and you sort of shepherded a lot of that land into what it became. It also equipped you to go and, with the proceeds of that investment, go do some other really interesting things. Getting to the Dodgers, which was, we talk about things that people sit around and say, wow, what if I could ever own a storied sports franchise? And the Los Angeles Dodgers are at the top of that list. So how did you get from the parking lots and then what was next?
It was an interesting set of circumstances. And the older I get, the less I believe things happen by accident. I just think things happen for a reason. And I pay a lot more attention to that now than maybe I did when I was a younger man. But so the Red Sox were owned by a trust, the Yawkey Trust. The Yawkey family, or Mr. and Mrs. Yawkey actually, owned the team for a long time. And when Mrs. Yawkey passed away, there was a period of time where the Red Sox were going to have to be sold, 10-year period by law. And the proceeds were going to go for the benefit of a not-for-profit. And John Harrington was the managing partner, or the guy in charge of the Red Sox and running it for the trust. And interestingly, he was someone that knew Joe Cronin, who was a big name in baseball, commissioner of the American League, who was a good pal of my grandfather. And first time I met John Harrington, he made that connection because I knew he knew Mr. Crony. He said, oh yeah, your grandfather was one of Joe's cronies. And it was interesting because I mention it because when my grandfather owned the Braves with a bunch of other contractors, and it was Lou Perini who was the major owner of the team, these were guys that competed with each other. They were bidding on the same work. You know what I mean? They were competing by day, but they were partners in a sports team and got along great. So anyway, I met with Mr. Harrington and he was really interested in a new stadium for the Red Sox. He believed that the future of the club depended on that. And he had tried unsuccessfully to get a new stadium built on the waterfront. He wanted something like what was then called AT&T Park in San Francisco, right on the bay in San Francisco where the Giants played. And I asked him if it would be okay if I made a run at it, because you know, I had some really deep relationships in South Boston. I ran the South Boston Neighborhood House for volunteer president for 10 years. And I think I understood the community and its wants and needs, not as well as somebody living there every day, but better than most otherwise. And so I went to the community and talked to them about a new stadium. And this was after the Patriots had been turned down on building a new stadium. And so I was coming at it from a little bit of a different place though, right, and saying like, how can we do this in a way where the community will embrace it? And after a lot of discussions and a lot of help, and lo and behold, we got approval to build a new ballpark on our land there. And so that's when I became a serious bidder for the Red Sox, because everybody knew at some point within that 10-year period it was going to be sold. And so we were one of the finalists. And there's another great Bostonian recently passed Joe O'Donnell, who was another one of the finalists, and he was teamed up with Steve Karp. And then what happened was I got a phone call around Thanksgiving of, what year was it? I think it was 2001. I have to check my math, but I'm pretty sure. And a guy told me, someone had a pretty good pipeline to baseball, and said, we're not going to get it. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, baseball's made a decision to sell the team to a gentleman by the name of John Henry, and they're going to buy the Montreal Expos. Baseball was going to buy the Expos. The Expos is going to buy the Marlins that John owned, and then the owner of the Marlins, i.e. John, is going to join up with Tom Werner and buy the Red Sox. And it's all subject to what baseball wants to do. And so this was not I was disappointed, but I wasn't shocked. It made a lot of sense that baseball was solving for more than one thing at a time. Yeah. And John Henry, by the way, was already, as I said, an owner. And yeah, it all made sense. And so all that happened, right? Baseball bought the Expos. They're now in Washington, owned by the Lerner family, and the team in Florida changed hands a couple times. And John and joined with Tom and Larry Lucchino at the time. And Tom's group had focused on saving Fenway. They were focused on keeping Fenway and renovating it. And so when John got involved in that group, the idea of a new stadium was off the table. It was all about renovating Fenway and so forth. And they've done a great job. Yeah. They've done a great job renovating Fenway and that whole area. And that's how it all kind of played out. And as I said, disappointed, but not surprised. And believe me when I tell you, as a kid growing up in Watertown, playing baseball my whole life, the Braves left Boston the year I was born. So I knew nothing of that experience other than scrapbooks. But growing up a Red Sox fan, taking my kids to Fenway and being there with my mom and dad and being there with my friends and my family and lots of amazing memories. And to be that kid, I was a little kid with a baseball glove and throwing a ball around, to be bidding on the Red Sox and being a finalist in that process, it was great. And so I didn't leave it disappointed as much as I left it like, wow, am I lucky? I did go down to Major League Baseball in Park Avenue, though, and I said,
now you have the itch.
Yeah. No, it was the opposite. I wanted to make sure I hadn't stepped on anybody's toes inadvertently. Wow. Because you guys know Boston. There are only three things that matter in Boston: sports, politics, and revenge. And all kidding aside, sports and politics, when you mix those two things up, there's a lot of fur flies, right? And so there was a lot of jockeying and this and that. I just wanted to make sure that the book was closed, right, and that I didn't inadvertently poke someone in the eye, and that everything was good. And Bob Dupay, who was the president of Major League Baseball and ran the thing for Bud, he said, no, everything's good. And he said, as a matter of fact, we were wondering if you'd like to buy another club. And I said, oh, wow, let me think about that. I really appreciate that. But I didn't go in there saying, you know, I didn't get the Red Sox, what else is for sale? It was nothing like that. I said, let me get back to you.
It's fascinating. When we started the conversation, I jumped the gun and we talked a little bit about the Dodgers. And you made some incredible trades in real estate with the Dodgers. And again, we talked a bit about that. And we want to get a little bit to the reason that really you're here today and what you're up to these days and what those trades have enabled, namely Project Liberty and the book that you wrote. You have been an incredibly philanthropic person. You've given hundreds of millions of dollars away to places like Georgetown and very important causes. And philanthropy is something important to us that we talk to all of our guests about. But perhaps your most enduring legacy will be what you're up to now, what you're spending most of your time on now. So I think we want to talk for a bit about that now.
You got the Dodgers chapter, you purchased the Dodgers, and if you want to tell the story of how it all happened and sold the Dodgers, but that capital and those proceeds equipped you to go and invest in other businesses, other sectors very successfully. And then it sort of comes down the path to your passion today. And how did that all unravel? How did this Project Liberty come to be and the steps that equipped you to be there?
Yeah, so life is a bit more complicated than the simple story, but to simplify it, I was able to basically take the value, the equity I had created in the Seaport, because a lot of great stuff was happening, as I mentioned, with infrastructure and all that, and make a trade where I could sell that property to Rupert Murdoch and Fox in exchange for the Dodgers, which was the most important asset, but they also owned 300 acres in downtown LA. And the wild card was going to be who owned the media asset, because RSNs, which are on their last legs now in most places, but at the time they were really the way we consume sports. The Dodgers, because they were owned by Fox, they hadn't really launched an RSN like YES Network or NESN and so forth. So that was a gigantic opportunity. So you really had, you know, as you say, great dirt, and it was able to buy more great dirt in LA, a huge media opportunity, and most importantly, one of the great brands in all of sports. And so made that trade, but I realized that nothing mattered if we couldn't put the luster back on the Dodgers, because as I said, they hadn't won a postseason game in a long, long time. So we went to work rebuilding the club, and again, ground up. We had done spring training in Vero Beach, Florida, which made a lot of sense when the team was in Brooklyn. Made no sense when the team was in LA. So we created a new, brand new spring training facility just outside of Phoenix in Glendale, Arizona, called Camelback Ranch. We rebuilt our farm system completely and, you know, just got realigned and renovated Dodger Stadium and et cetera, and started winning baseball games. And so, as I said, in that first year, we were super lucky. We won that first postseason game that the club hadn't won in 16 years. And then we built from there. And then it got really interesting. Joe Torre was my manager. Don Mattingly was his bench coach. We had Manny join us for a period of time. And that was, you know, fun craziness.
Like Nomar too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And we had made a great run in 08, 09. We're just really inches away from the World Series. You know, we won back-to-back National League Championship Series and so forth. But unfortunately, what happened at the same time is I got divorced. And that really changed everything, and then decided that the best way forward for everyone was to sell the team. I was able to keep the real estate, which was nice, and set up the RSN before selling it, which added massively to the value, and sold it to Mark Walter and the Guggenheim Group, and become great friends with Mark and the folks at Guggenheim. We've had done a lot of business together subsequently. So it's worked out for everyone. And you look at the Dodgers now, they were able to capitalize on that media opportunity. They're one of the really top, top clubs in all of sports. And you see what they're doing with Otani and Momoto, and they're playing in Korea right now. Are the Dodgers going to lose a game this year?
It's been pretty good.
And so again, it's great. I'm happy for them. I'm most especially happy for the fans. And Magic was part of the deal, and it was just a great way to say, okay, that era is over. And as we talked about earlier, I was able to buy another club in France, which has been a great joy. But my real passion right now is Project Liberty and the work that I'm engaged in and all these other businesses and projects and teams. You know, I can't tell you, I enjoy them so much, and it's amazing to have the opportunity to build and rebuild and create. But look, we have a big problem right now in this country and in the world, and we have some infrastructure that is starting to control our lives in ways that I think is very unhealthy, and we need to start addressing that.
Yeah. When I first started learning, Frank, about what you're up to in this chapter of your life, which is incredible, and my eyes have been completely opened, something that sort of been right under my nose, but I realize how it connects to our lives. Project Liberty, I was referring it to as kind of fixing the internet, but I think you probably have a better way to put it. And it seems like an abstract idea at first. I read your book that just came out about a week ago, Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. And I think as we invite you here to talk about this a little bit, I think this is going to hit home for everyone. We are all living through this right now, and I don't think that most of us appreciate the crisis that's unfolding in front of us. So how did this passion get ignited, and what is Project Liberty? If you could just sort of go right into it. We want you to run with this for a few minutes because it's an important topic for all of us. And I think that this is ambitious, but you're tackling what's one of the most serious problems in the world right now.
Yeah. And the key here will be, can we do this together? Can we actually build an army here of people that care about this? And I believe we can. And I think the moms are probably going to lead the charge, because once you start messing with children, moms and dads get very, very, very concerned. And that's what's happening now. So I wrote Our Biggest Fight to shine light on Project Liberty, which you're right, it is a project to fix the internet. And it's clearly broken. When you have bad infrastructure, you fix it. And you damn well better fix it before you make it more powerful. And we're on the dawn of the generative artificial intelligence age, which is, make no mistake, just a more powerful version of the same broken design. So I believe we need to fix the tech if we're going to address the problems that we have out in the world. And the point I make in the book is that a lot of the problems we have in the world are not fixable unless we fix the tech. I mean, you referred to climate change as another big problem. Well, we're not going to fix climate change if we can't agree that we have climate change, right? I mean, if we can continue to argue about whether the Earth is flat or round and get stuck in that, if we had technology like we have now, when there was a debate about whether the world was flat or the world was round, we'd have lots of fake videos showing people that believed the world was flat, that the world was flat. And they'd stick with that position, and we'd never get out of that. We'd all be 50% thinking it was flat and 50% thinking it was round, and we'd all just sit and argue. Facts matter. Truth matters. And we have an information ecosystem now powered by this technology that is completely contaminating and corrupting our information ecosystem. It's making us ungovernable. We see our democracy failing. And as I said earlier, most importantly, it's harming children. And I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know and you don't see. And all of your listeners, they see it, they know it, particularly ones with kids or grandkids. This is a crisis and we need to address it. And I'd really urge people to start thinking about, well, every time they hear the word data, think personhood. Move in your head. It's not data, it's me. It's me in the digital age. It's everything about me that's scraped by these platforms and is then used in ways that is not helping me. It's actually following me, targeting me, and manipulating me. And that's very, very unhealthy. So the reason I use Thomas Paine as the inspiration for the book is that goes back to 1775. We're going back to Boston and the Tea Party here, guys. So we're... they did something. You know, they marched to the harbor and dumped all that tea in because they said to the king, we're getting tired of just being treated as subjects, right? Paine did a great job with it in less than 50 pages. He wrote something called Common Sense, and he really framed this as an issue of, do you want to continue to be a subject of a monarch where you don't have rights, you can't own things, or do you want to be a citizen? And it was a radical concept, right? Being a citizen, and you have the same rights as the king. You're born with it. These became what we call unalienable rights, as captured in the Declaration of Independence. And so we entered an age where we were something. It wasn't like our forebears where they got to farm their little plot, keep a little bit to eat, keep the family sustained, and then give the rest of it away to the manor house or to the king or queen. No, we're individuals that have a worth and a beauty to each and every one of us that should be given this thing called liberty. Given choice, given agency, we can decide who we want to govern us. We can speak, you know, quote, self-governed of, by, for the people, and we can own things. I mean, this whole business of real estate is driven by a whole concept of private property, right? We lived in a world that concept didn't exist. And now look at this great country and what we've built over a period of a couple hundred years. When you give people liberty and you open up the spirit of entrepreneurship, the spirit of innovation and creativity, we're only limited by our imagination. And I would argue we need far, far more civic imagination right now than we have because we're stuck. We're stuck because of technology that was built to be decentralized and to empower all of us and make our lives better has been hijacked by a few platforms who have turned it into something that wasn't intended. We now have centralized, autocratic, exploitive, surveillance-based technology that is ruling our lives. And if I asked you guys to describe democracy, I don't think you'd say centralized, autocratic, exploitive, right, or surveillance-based. But yet we have technology that is that way. So we're at a very important point here where something's got to give. Either we're going to have a different political system that looks a lot more like autocracy, which is centralized, autocratic, surveillance-based governing system that conforms now to this tech we have, or we need the tech to conform to the type of governing system we want, which is decentralized, protects people, doesn't exploit them, doesn't surveil them, and so forth. I hear over and over again, we need a digital Bill of Rights. I don't believe we do. I think we already have a Bill of Rights, that we need our technology to actually protect. We need our rights back. And so why would we give up those rights just to use the internet. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. It's like saying, give up your rights to use a road, right? It's the infrastructure you used to build at McCourt, right? It's the same infrastructure.
It is, and it should be working for us, not against us. Look, I want to be a citizen in the digital age. I want to be a digital citizen. I don't want to give up my citizenship and become a digital subject. We're subjects now. We're products. We're just being exploited. And we see this with this whole TikTok discussion, right? How harmful it is and so on and so forth. And even our Congress is acting in a bipartisan way. But they're focused on what? The China issue, because our information is being scraped and shipped to China.
When it becomes geopolitical, they start to focus on
No, when it becomes about an enemy outside, they can focus. So they're focusing on China. But big tech wants nothing more than everybody to focus on China. It's not them. Because big tech, it's the same technology here that big tech is using. And sometimes the enemy within is more dangerous than the enemy outside. And so I think we have a moment here where we need to hit the pause button for a sec, zoom out, say, what do we care about? What is important to us? And then have the tech optimize for it. And I talk about democracy and mis- and disinformation and how corrupted our information ecosystem is. But I think what's now front and center on people's minds, and it should be, is the harms to young people. I'm a fifth generation builder. I understand how infrastructure works. I have that perspective. But most importantly, I'm a father of seven. That's the perspective I want to talk about now, because that's what matters here. I'm blessed. Six boys, one daughter. And my daughter's 8 years old. She came home from school the other day in tears. Why? Two of her friends are on TikTok. Don't want to be her friend anymore because she's not on TikTok.
That's the hard part for parents. I haven't faced it yet. My daughter's 18 months old. Mike has three boys. And your oldest, George, is probably getting to the point where some of his peers might be getting cell phones or have access to iPads. But I think about how you weigh as a parent the damage that this technology and this content can do to a young mind. Weigh that against the danger of a friend being sort of alienated from a friend group or being out of the mix because they're not adopting it. So that's a big part of the challenge, it would seem to me.
Yeah, so Jonathan Haidt, who's a Project Liberty fellow and just wrote a piece in The Atlantic, which I urge everybody to read because he's an NYU professor and he's done the research now over the last decade or so. And he can prove that this is connected. When I say this, the anxiety, the depression, the thoughts of suicide, the actual suicides, the rewiring of young people's brains is connected to this predatory, addictive technology. And he really is raising the alarm bell, as all of us are. And I would urge everybody to dig a little deeper here into the harms and the problems. And what I want to talk about in a moment with Project Liberty are the solutions, because that's what we're really focused on as builders. How do you solve a problem? Not how do you just sit and complain about it? But I do want to give you one quick example that I use from time to time. Like, imagine I came to you as the head of the Postal Service and I said, I'm going to give you free mail from now on. No stamps. You don't have to pay for it. Okay, you might say, what's the deal? Here's the deal. I'm going to put a camera in every room of your house, in your car, in your office. I'm going to surveil you 24 hours a day. I'm sure your reaction would be, that's creepy. And then I'd say, yeah, but it's free. Well, one other thing. I'm going to open your mail. I'm going to read your mail. Everything I read is now mine, including your relationships, your ideas, and everything else. I own you now. That's mine. Probably say, that's not fair. And I'd say, oh, one other thing I have to tell you. But remember, it's free. One other thing I want to tell you. I'm going to read your 13-year-old daughter's diary. And like every 13-year-old, she's insecure. It has some things she's worried about. Maybe it's her weight or whatever. And I'm going to say, you know what? I found out your daughter's concerned about her weight. I have stuff I want to sell her. And by the way, I'm going to feed her stuff that makes her feel worse about herself. And I'm going to make money doing it. So now it's creepy, it's unfair, and it's downright harmful. So why would we accept that kind of technology, that kind of infrastructure? If we had a water system that was piping poison into everybody's homes and we knew it, and households were getting sick and kids were dying, would we sit around and say, well, it's water. Some of it's good. I need some water. We'd say, this is ridiculous. This is ridiculous. And we need to fix it. And we need to do it fast, because there is a growing number of people in America, young people, that don't know what life was like before, when you had real relationships and you had real friends and you had each other's back and you had great memories and you had stuff to lean on, a community to lean on and so forth. And it's a crisis for sure.
And not only are we allowing it into our homes and our lives, we're inviting it. we're addicted to it. Adults are addicted to their phones, and whether it's Instagram or reading online, adults are always on their phones too much. Parents all say, hey, we're the problem too. But when you watch kids, you know, 12, 13-year-old kids walk down the street, and it's a group of three or four of them, and instead of talking or throwing a ball or messing around, they're all looking down at their cell phones and they're 10 feet apart because they don't care about talking to the other one. They're just on TikTok or doing whatever. It's sad, but it's an addiction. And I think that's where it hits home for me. I have three young kids and I'm saying, God, I wish they could have just grown up the way we did, which was awesome. Our generation is pretty lucky in a lot of ways. We're inviting it into our homes. And I think when you translate that into the power of data and these algorithms that are feeding and manipulating everyone that's on a phone, that's where it starts to click for me as a parent. I think the universal language here is protecting your kids or your grandkids.
And I think there's impacts on commerce too and the way that the world is working. You alluded to it. This young woman, she is being fed these ads, being fed these messages about buying particular products or doing particular things. And I don't think we'll see the ramifications of that sort of tunnel vision that these people get into for years and years and years, because it sort of self-selects. You stay in your lane, you don't try new things, and your first point on creativity. There's no real creativity anymore because people are just spoon-fed what they're already thinking, and that's validated by what they're looking at on their phone or on their iPad. Yeah. So I think that impact will be hard to see, and it's going to take years to see it.
I think you're totally correct, and I want to go back to the point about invited into our homes. We have kind of invited it, but I think it's also more insidious than that. And I don't think it's necessarily, you know, fair to put it on the shoulders of parents. This technology is so omnipresent. It has crept into all facets of our lives. To think that parents have to take on the responsibility and have the guilt, right, of saying, do I let my child on social media and worry about the harms I'm doing to them? Or do I deprive them of it completely and then worry about the harms I'm doing to them, you know, because they're not with their friends? I think we need to, first of all, to realize that this technology is everywhere. We've heard of the Internet of Things and so on and so forth. So it's, did we invite this into our television sets in our home? Did we invite this into our Ring camera? Did we invite this into Siri or Alexa? Did we invite this into the Nest camera that looks at our little baby? Did we invite this into our car, which is a smartphone on wheels? Or did it happen and we weren't quite aware of it? Okay, yeah. So part of it is the smartphone, which is certainly how this is all proliferated. But I want us all to realize, and I would urge people to just take a few hours of their precious time, read the book. The proceeds are going to the not-for-profit portion of Project Liberty. It's not about money. It's about awareness. We need to ring the alarm, and it needs to be a call to action, because it's not going to happen by some infrastructure guy. Hey, Frank, go fix this problem. No. This has to be a movement of people understanding that we are not doing our job as adults. Our most important job is to protect the next generation, protect our children and all children. We are failing at that job. We can't let it happen. And so the point about parents having kind of this Hobson's choice between no social media or all of it, there isn't a third way here. We can't have kids connected without the toxicity. I'm pretty sure we can. And that's why I'd urge you to read the book. I don't want to get too geeky about this in terms of how it can be fixed, but it can be fixed. This is just technology. This isn't something that is divine, spiritual. This is technology that men have created.
We created it. We can fix it. And let's fix it before the gasoline of AI really gets too deep into it. And the book completely opened my eyes, and people can buy the book online. You can get it on Audible too. It really opened my eyes to the urgency of the issue, and it lays out real solutions, which to someone who's not a tech person going into reading it, I was saying, am I going to understand this? But it's put forth pretty simply because we did create this technology. We can fix it before it gets too out of control. And that article that you mentioned, The Atlantic, the headline of the article was End the Phone-Based Childhood Now. End the phone-based childhood now. And that was like a ripple, you know, sent a shockwave to a lot of parents that I know. And I'm going to make sure your book gets in all their hands because I think this is really an important topic, but it's urgent.
Yeah, no, it is definitely urgent. And we've learned, by the way, that the CEOs of these companies now know the harms that their platforms are doing. So this is no longer something where we can go to the CEOs and say, hey, did you realize this? Change it. We now know they realized it and didn't change it. So wouldn't it be great if they just changed
how
it all
worked? That's not the easy button is just to convince them.
And then in the normal pre-internet world, we would then go to our politicians and say, look, they're not changing it. And you got to make sure we fix this. But unfortunately, our politicians are being disabled in our political system by the same technology that's affecting kids. And we literally have people now in their own camps, 100% sure that they're correct, and they're not moving. And then there's a mirror reflection, right, of a second camp where people are 100% sure that they're right and they're not moving. So I would say the algorithms have worked perfectly well. We're all at the point now where we're stuck and we're sure. And two groups cannot both be 100% correct. And it's why I said about the world is flat, the world is round. I mean, what wouldn't have happened in the world if we were stuck in that debate and we didn't discover that what we thought was true was not true? We've learned something and we've gotten smarter, and then we can get smarter yet. And this whole technology was designed to make us smarter, not make us stupider. It was designed to help us, not hurt us. And it can be redesigned. I want to be clear. I'm pro technology. I'm pro the internet. We build these systems, for gosh sakes, right? And we're proud of that, but we're not proud of how it's being used right now. And so that's what we need to fix.
Yeah. And I think we focus, because we're young dads, on children in the beginning of the conversation. But when you talk about the political divisiveness and what it's doing to just our country, if you look at where we are as a country, man, we've never been more divided. And you're right. People are absolutely sure that they're on the right side here. The reality is probably somewhere in the middle, but it's not just kids who are being affected. It's everyone. And this has infiltrated every aspect of our life, unfortunately.
I think there are a lot of our generation even who rely on social media platforms, whether it's X, whether it's Facebook, Instagram. That's where they get information about things like politics. You know, they're not getting the Washington Post anymore, reading the Times, reading the Globe. They're getting the information from incredible novice reporters on Twitter. And that's scary. So it's dangerous for parents, for adults too, not just for the kids. And I think you're right. It's not about the mechanics necessarily of how do we fix it. It's as much about opening folks' eyes that this is the issue. Here's what's going to happen if we continue down this road.
And recognize that it is fixable and we're not stuck with this. I know this is powerful technology. I know these firms are huge and rich and powerful. But it doesn't mean that we can't change it. This country, we've gotten to where we are because we innovate, we build, we create. And in this particular case, something's gone off the rails. Let's fix it and then build, innovate, create some more and build some more. But optimizing for people, for democracy, for children, and so forth. Not letting something that just because it's big and powerful affect all of our lives. We have two basic operating systems in the country. A political operating system and an economic operating system, right? One is called democracy, the other is called capitalism. Together, we have a capitalist democracy. That's how we function. Both of these systems operate based on one incredibly important and simple thing: trust. You destroy trust, you definitely destroy democracy. Mm-hmm. And what I want people to realize, because in the real estate business and in other businesses and entrepreneurs like you and the people that listen to you, if you destroy trust, you destroy our economic system as well. Name for me, other than maybe Singapore, a single thriving market economy that's not a democracy. These things go together. And it's not like this stuff doesn't matter. This is our political system. This is our economic system. This is our way of life. This is our children. This is the future. And for us, we just got to get out of where we're in right now to get to that better place and do it before we allow a more powerful version to be put in place, because generative AI is just a more powerful version of the same thing. And by the way, generative AI or large language models need huge data sets and immense compute power. Who are the companies that have huge data sets and immense compute power?
Right. And we're feeding them every day.
So the same five companies are going to be the same five companies. Now, and I guess if you own a share of stock in that company, oh, look, they'll be more valuable. But what we're talking about is not a share price, or we will open up so much economic opportunity. Look, when we built RCN, we heard at the time, and that was led by my brother David, we heard, oh, it will never happen because there's seven oligarchs and they'll never let it change and they can't be interoperable and it must be this way. We proved differently. You can build something better. And there'd be no 5G if companies like ours and others didn't step forward and say, you know what? Having a phone number owned by a carrier that only has a geographic area and your phone number doesn't speak to someone else in another part of the country and you have to be on the same service to speak to a person. You know what I mean? Yeah. It sounds like pretty stupid, right? Silly. Young people wouldn't say, you're kidding, right? My phone number didn't work if I moved from or traveled for the day from Boston to Miami or LA or Chicago. That's the way it was. Your phone number wasn't portable. If you went out of the range of the oligarch that had control of the Northeast first, and you went to the West or the Midwest or the South, you had another oligarch that controlled it. You needed another phone number. It's silly. Why not have control of our data and have it be portable? And why not have the new apps that are built be interoperable and click on our terms of use rather than us clicking on these silly terms of use of these big platforms? We can fix this. And it's just a matter of will. And I really appreciate you guys taking the time to dig in and read the book and urge others to read it and so forth. And I hope they do, because I kept it short for a reason, because we all lead busy lives. But this is an issue that is of great urgency. And I really appreciate what you're all doing.
No, I think we're struck by, and this is originally when we reached out and wanted to sit down with you, I was sort of scratching my head saying, why Frank McCourt, all this enormous success, investing in interesting things around the world, and now he wants to fix the internet. There must be something that's igniting that passion. And it seemed very abstract when I first heard about it. And when I read the book, my eyes were completely opened. I think everyone's else's will be when they get their hands on the book. We need to meet the moment, and it goes beyond children. It's everyone. This is infiltrating every corner of your life. And people aren't aware of this going on, unless you're sort of a student of internet policy and ethics and data and everything that's going on. This is not something you're paying attention to, but we all should be. So we feel fortunate to be able to have this conversation with you, get it out to the folks that are in our community and listen to these interviews. I think this is going to be eye-opening for many. I think a lot of people will be surprised by where this conversation went, especially in the Boston, New York sort of alley here from a real estate standpoint. People are fascinated by the Frank McCourt story. A lot of people are going to be wondering what you're up to. This is a Herculean task in some ways, but I think the book lays out a very achievable way to go and attack this, which is great.
Yeah, well, I'm not Hercules, so we're not going to be able to do this alone. I didn't call it my biggest fight. It's called our biggest fight. And we have some big Goliaths out there, but I'll bet on the millions of Davids, and we can change this. And by the way, I'm not, like I say, anti-tech. I'm pro-tech. I would love to see these big platforms change the way they operate and really treat us as human beings, and with the dignity and respect that children deserve, democracy deserves, each and every one of us deserve. And again, I'm so thrilled to be having this conversation in my hometown and right out here overlooking the harbor. And I think about this in very foundational terms. There's a reason why I chose the American Project and Thomas Paine to talk about this. We are at a moment where we need to decide, are we going to be citizens in this internet era? Or are we going to be subjects? And I, for one, am not going to rest until we win this, because I'm here because of the blood, sweat, and tears of my parents and their parents and their parents and their parents, right? Who literally got on a boat not knowing exactly what was on the other side of that ocean. And they didn't call them coffin ships for nothing, to come here to make a better life for what ultimately became a better life for me. This is our responsibility. And I think Bostonians understand this issue because it all started here. And I think Bostonians have a spirit that's different. And I've had the privilege of living in other places and traveling in a lot of places. And each place has its own unique attributes and beauty and strengths. But here in Boston, we understand what it means to stand up to power. We understand what it means to have rights, to protect those rights, and to speak out about them. Bostonians, I don't know, maybe it's the water we drank growing up or something, but we certainly care about this stuff, and we don't just complain about it. You know, I'll leave you with this story. When I was a kid growing up in Watertown, Mass, one of seven siblings. Picture it, nine at the dinner table. We always had a friend over or someone that stopped in, and or my parents had guests. So dozen people typically at the dinner table, and we're having conversations. And like all kids, me and my sibs were pretty good at identifying problems, and we'd complain about this or that. And we had the problems pretty well figured out. And not a dinner would end without my mom saying, "Hey kids, you've done a really great job of figuring out what's wrong. Now, what are you going to do about it?"
I love that. It's a great lesson to instill from a young age.
I bet you heard that too from your mom and dad.
Jen Greeley was similar, and we were lucky to have her and my father. Frank, you've been incredibly gracious with your time here. We know you're a busy person with a lot of things to do. So we thank you for sitting down with us for this time. And I think more importantly, thank you for the work that you're doing. You're rolling up your sleeves and you're out there having conversations like this. You wrote a book that, you know, you're not doing it for financial gain. You're doing it to fix this problem, which we can all see. Everybody can sympathize with. So you have two believers in us. We hope that our listeners will go out and buy the book. Again, it's Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. If you don't want to buy it, we're going to buy a bunch here. Send us your mailing address and we'll forward it to you. We agree. It's incredibly important stuff, and it's something that everybody needs to be thinking about. So thank you for the time. Thank you for what you're doing. It was great to spend some time with you.
Thanks, Frank. We could have spent 3 hours on the real estate and the investing and the different chapters of your life and career, but this Project Liberty, I think, is the most powerful, and it's going to be a great legacy for everyone that gets behind it. So we're thrilled to be now a part of it. We're on board. It's been right under our nose, but this conversation and reading the book really illuminated the crisis for us. So,
well, thanks for having me, and pleasure to be with you. And let me just say, we could talk for hours about this, but we all lead real lives. What we talked about is a real life I've led, and the blessings I've had and the experiences I've had and the failures I've had, as well as the successes, right, that taught me what I know. But I had the benefit of great parents who developed character in me and great teachers. My point is, it's about a real life. We all have real lives, not just these virtual lives. And I think we just remembering that we're people that need people, that everybody comes from somewhere, real place, and we need to reconnect to that. And that to me is really, really very, very important, because the power of the tech and the connectivity and so forth is awesome, but it's not going to replace real life, real experiences, real relationations.
We completely
agree.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you guys for doing what you're doing.